Welcome to Behind the Curtain, Nashville's Movers, Shakers,
and Tastemakers,
brought to you by Cord Real Estate, your key to the heart of Nashville. I'm Steve Luther alongside my co-host, Van Hoy.
Here we peel back the layers of Nashville's vibrant scene, sitting down with the innovators, creators, and leaders who shape our city. From music to business and everything in between, we dive into the journeys that have brought them to where they are today.
We're here to uncover the stories behind the success, the passion driving their pursuits, and why they've chosen Nashville as their stage. It's about the people who dream big, push boundaries, and make this city truly unique.
So join us as we explore the heart and soul of Nashville through the eyes of those who know it best.
We're excited to welcome Dr. Dave Vigorist, a distinguished figure in the field of molecular pathology and genomics, as the Chief Scientific Officer at Spectrum Solutions. Dr. Vigorist has been instrumental in advancing medical device innovation. With over two decades of experience in biomedical consulting and development, he's also the CEO and founder of Strategic Biosciences, LLC. And Dr. Vigorist is known for his significant contributions to immunology, infectious disease research, and precision medicine, holding several patents and developing novel scientific methods.
It's impressive.
Just a smart guy with us today.
Yeah, I'd say so. I'd say.
Well, let's jump into it. So, as a chief scientific officer at Spectrum, you've been involved in pioneering medical device innovation. What's one of the most exciting projects that you've worked on, and what's been kind of its impact on the field?
Within Spectrum, we were the first company to do an EUA for COVID testing. That was in partnership with Rutgers. So we've been developing devices for the last 20 years or so, the majority of which have been, you know, for other companies like, you know, the ancestry companies and home diagnostics, that sort of thing. Now we've decided to move into a more broad avenue than just devices. We're now in compound pharmacy. We're making peptides. We've acquired recently a laboratory now to do our own diagnostics. So we're trying to build a diagnosis to treatment sort of plan and pathway so that we can engineer the devices, do the testing, provide the therapeutic on the other end, and make sure that patients and consumers have a front to back all-inclusive solution.
And you said an EUA. What is that?
That's an emergency use authorization. So okay. Anytime there's something new that comes out, a new virus infection, a new disease, oftentimes there are a number of corporations and companies and groups that are trying to find a therapeutic or a test or a diagnostic. So the FDA can award these emergency use authorizations in a time of stress. They did that for COVID. They did that previously for Ebola. And it's just a way of fast tracking some therapeutics or diagnostics to the market so that the normal course of time that it takes to get through an FDA is sometimes a decade or more. This is a way of getting something to the medical community quicker. And it has just as much of a rigorous evaluation, but it's done in a fast track methodology. So it allows us to be able to get to market quick. Oftentimes the CDC can use this kind of thing if they identify a technology that's useful for a given emergency, then they can appeal to the FDA for emergency use authorization. That sometimes happens with rare diseases as well. You know, if a company finds a new therapeutic or a new diagnostic, they can appeal to the FDA to get this used in kind of a compassionate use. It doesn't have to go through the typical long process that the FDA requires for general approval.
Mm-hmm. What kind of device innovation was involved with COVID?
It was a saliva collection device. So it was a fairly straightforward device that we've seen before.
Like the long Q-tip?
No. This is strictly just saliva. So this is a non-invasive way of collecting the sample.
Okay.
And part of the technology that we've developed is a preservative agent that's behind it that allows this to be preserved and doesn't require cold chain storage. So a lot of the problem with diagnostics is that it requires ice, requires that the sample be shipped on some kind of controlled temperature. That's a deficit in terms of getting things in quickly and inexpensively. So we've devised a number of different solutions that allow us to not only preserve and transport nucleic acids like DNA and RNA that you find in viruses and bacteria,
right,
but also to preserve proteins. So this is leading us into an avenue of innovation now where we can preserve all kinds of proteins that don't require cold chain. So typically, if we wanted to test you for protein of interest, we'd have to draw some blood. That blood has to be shipped on blue ice or on dry ice. If it's not, then the analyte that you're interested in degrades. And by the time it gets to the lab, it's not useful anymore.
So what's the accuracy of a saliva test versus another type of, for COVID, for example, a saliva test versus the swab of your nostril versus whatever other forms they have?
It's almost perfect agreement between the saliva and the swab.
Wow.
All the swab is really collecting is just the mucus from your sinus cavity. That same mucus is also, bathed in your oral cavity and down into your throat and your nasopharynx. So you don't have to reach back there necessarily to get to it. The saliva is collecting some of that from that mucus in the back of your throat, and it's being distributed throughout the entire saliva.
So when everything hit with COVID and all the stuff that happened, did you, were you watching the news and seeing people driving into the parking lots to get swabbed and all that? Were you shaking your head, or were you feeling like, just do this thing? What were you feeling
It took a bit of time for people to realize that saliva was a worthwhile sample type. And saliva is still something that I think a lot of people don't understand
doctors just showed up.
Doctors, researchers, people at large,
right,
don't really have a good understanding of what can be tested, what can be examined using saliva. Saliva is a great sample type. It doesn't work for everything, obviously.
Right.
When you're trying to get in line to get your swab done at one of these sampling facilities, right, or locations, you're sitting in your car, you're taking time away from work. One of the things that this really opened up, and we probably did about 30 million tests with our devices. So that's how many COVID tests were done with our technology. Just for our technology. Right. And there are a couple of others in the market. There are a couple of universities that came up with this, with a method also for using saliva. Ours was a little more thoughtfully done because we had prior experience with saliva before for COVID. So it wasn't something that was developed on the fly. And these other,
even though everybody thought that was what was going on.
Yeah. These other groups, I mean, they do a great job. I'm not saying anything negative about them. We had just been doing saliva collection prior to COVID and had been in this space for the last 18 years making devices and such. So we had already had some experience. We had already had some chemical engineering behind the solutions that we were building. And since then we have further modified them and improved upon them. So that now not only can we do nucleic acid, but now we can do proteins. And prior to joining Spectrum, I was with a company that was really interested in this in terms of immune aging. So how do we look at saliva to give us a window on how your immune system is aging over time?
Wow.
So if I could do that with saliva, as opposed to having you come in and draw blood, once a month or twice a month or whatever the frequency is, then you're more likely to be compliant with the kind of tests and the examination, right? So Spectrum has been in this space for long enough now that we've worked through a lot of the engineering on not only the device, but also the solutions that offer this preservative power.
And this is all happening here in Nashville?
No, actually the company is based out of Salt Lake City.
Oh.
We do everything in-house in Salt Lake City.
Okay.
But the company that we acquired, this diagnostic company, also has a manufacturing arm, and it was founded here in Nashville.
Gotcha.
It has since moved to Huntsville, to the Hudson Alpha Institute in Huntsville, but it was a spin out of Vanderbilt. So it originated here. That technology is also likewise very innovative. We have the capability for making assays in nucleic acid or proteins across anything that you would desire to have. So if you said, I want to do XYZ protein, well, if we can identify XYZ protein, we can build an assay to measure it and measure it with very high degree of sensitivity and specificity. So that means that we can be very accurate in terms of what we're measuring.
Well, as the chief experience officer, not scientific officer, the chief experience officer of Cord Real Estate, I appreciate the experience of spitting versus shoving stick up my nose. Sure. So.
And that was one of the biggest complaints, right?
Right.
People just...
Is it too far? Is it far enough?
Far enough?
I don't know.
Twist it this way, that
right.
way. You know, that other device that they had out where you could do it. Some people try to do this at home, right?
Of course.
And I've done that kind of sampling on myself for many years. But if you're at home and you're pushing that thing back into your sinuses,
I don't know.
Okay, do I go until it stops?
Right.
Right. I mean, what do I do?
Tell it. What do we do?
What do you do? So...
like this,
get a saliva test. That's what you think.
The saliva collection device is a lot easier. You just passively, you know, expectorate into the tube. You put the cap on it. The solution that preserves it just drops into the saliva, mixes it up, and then it's stable. At that point, you could put it in the mailbox. You could leave it in a UPS box in the middle of the summer in Arizona, and it's perfectly fine.
It doesn't get heated.
It doesn't get degraded. So the big innovation there was finding the right combination of solution to preserve the nucleic acid so that it can be transported. And that's here in the US. We have business overseas in other countries that we can ship anything from anywhere in the world and still get it here in a condition that allows us to do our diagnostics.
Interesting. And so that's with the DNA as well. Mm-hmm. All the different companies that do that.
Right. We don't supply to everybody that does that.
Right.
We supply to a fair number of them.
Cool.
Now you've got extensive experience in immunology and infectious diseases. I don't want to get too controversial, but COVID had
Steve a bit doesn't of want to get impact, controversial.
a bit of an impact on me.
It's a big part of his story.
We had talked a little bit offline. You had an opportunity to work with one of the foremost experts on Corona. He ended up not doing it because at the time they'd been studying it for like 30 years or something like that. And it was no big deal. I'm curious, just based on what you know, what's the likelihood that it was a natural mutation that led to this versus a man-made modification?
To me personally, it doesn't make sense to me that it so easily jumped from an animal to a human.
Mm-hmm.
So that leads me to think, and other things that have come out in the last 6 months or a year lead me to think that some of it may have been modified as a gain of function.
Mm.
And that's not unprecedented. 12 or 15 years ago, I worked with a group that had done some of that same kind of stuff. Not for any other reason than to find out if a virus had acquired this capability, what could happen to it, right?
Mm.
So this is a group out of Europe that had been very extensive, has done a lot of extensive study in respiratory viruses, and their particular target in that case was flu. And they had worked through what would happen if flu were to gain this particular capability. And they published a paper on it that quickly got retracted because they said, you can't go down that road, right? You can't do that. But we've seen, you know, most of the time when something goes from an animal to a human, there's a number of steps that are in between. That doesn't seem to have happened, at least to my mind, that doesn't seem to have happened here. You know, back in 1918, when we saw the Spanish flu, it went through a number of animal hosts before it gained enough function to survive in humans.
Mm.
Influenza typically is a bird virus.
Mm-hmm.
So it exists in chickens and ducks and stuff. And it's a natural virus for them. Doesn't cause them much more than just diarrhea. But when it jumps into another host, it gets... You know, it doesn't have any controls anymore. In the chicken, it has a control. So in that case, it went from the chicken, it went to the pig, and then eventually it came to the human. And once it got into the human, no controls, so it goes pandemic, mm-hmm. right? It becomes a pandemic. I think that's what happened here. But somewhere along the way, it gained some function that it probably shouldn't have had that quickly.
It went bionic.
It went very fast, right? And the speculation for a period of time was this was from a pangolin, which is kind of like an anteater. Well, how did it get from that to humans so quickly?
Right.
There's something in between. And in places of the world, you have areas where you have a number of different animals in very close proximity. So that can accelerate it, right? Because they're circulating, like in the zoo, for example, or or wet market, the animals are all there together. So given enough time, they spread it to each other and they gain function and they get better and they get better and they get better, and then it jumps to human. That didn't seem to happen here, unless I'm not privy to a lot of what might have gone on in nature. Then maybe it's been percolating for 5 years and gone through a bunch of animals and we just don't know it. So, but that's usually the process. It goes through several steps to gain this function. This one just seemed to have jumped right to the forefront. And you're right. I had the opportunity more than 20 years ago to work with somebody at the University of Colorado that was the expert in coronavirus. And at the time, coronaviruses just gave us the sniffles. Wow. No one really, I mean, people studied them to understand how they work and in their biology. And we have somebody here, a very prominent scientist here at Vanderbilt, who spent his career studying coronaviruses. And incredible. You know, now he's getting the attention he deserved for having studied the biology and understood more about it.
Right.
And he was probably very instrumental in trying to get that education out to not only the public and the consumers, but the medical community and the researchers behind, you know, doing the vaccine.
As a scientist, how did you interact with your social circle when it was getting so controversial and so nuts?
You mean in terms of like,
I had a friend in DC. I called as soon as I heard about that we were going to be on lockdown. I called a friend of mine in DC and said, "Hey, is this for real?" And she said, "Do exactly what you're told. It's for real." So I went to my expert. You know, if I knew you, I would have called you.
I didn't have quite the hysteria. You know, I was basically figuring, okay, we see this routinely. This happens a lot.
Okay.
Viruses and bacteria get introduced into this human population on a regular basis. And most of the time it doesn't do much, right? I thought it was kind of overkill in a lot of ways. And if you look at what's been, you know, what's been coming from some of the people who are in charge at the NIH lately, they're starting to say, we really didn't have a whole lot of evidence to support that. I sort of get the reason why they did it. But I think they just made too much panic.
A little more fear.
Yeah.
How about this X thing we're hearing?
X.
This big X next. Have you heard about that?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, well then I retract that question. Because
you've been watching too much TikTok.
Maybe that's what it is. It's a.
You know, there's
TikTok and Insta.
There's a continuous stream of pathogens that come into the human population, most of which just fizzle out, you know, and some of them stay around, but they have very, very specific routes of infection, right? You have to be exposed to blood. You have to be exposed to something very specific.
Right.
It's not usually something that just kind of spreads through the population and goes wildfire.
Maybe I need to stop looking at Twitter and maybe that's the X.
Maybe so.
Twitter paid.
Now you're a science guy. You've got a huge science background, medical background. You're also a C-suite person. You've been a CEO or our CEO. How do you blend the technical aspects of what you do with business? How does insurance come into play in this industry? How does regulation?
Well, there's a significant amount of regulation, right? Anytime you're developing diagnostics or therapeutics, there is four or five layers of regs that go along with it, right? For the diagnostic space, you know, at the very lowest level, you have CLIA, which is a federal program just to make sure that laboratories are performing the tests appropriately, that they've got the right controls in place, that they're doing everything that they can to be, you know, in the best interest of the public. Above that, then you have some organizations that also apply some regulations. In this case, on diagnostics, there's CAP, which is the College of American Pathologists. They put out standards as well that you're supposed to adhere to, again, make sure that you're doing the best you can for the consumer and for the medical provider, that they're getting information that's correct. The vast majority of our decision-making in healthcare comes from tests, comes from lab tests. And if that lab test is incorrect, then you go down the wrong path in treating your patient, which is not something we want to have. Above that, then you have FDA and you have, you know, these other national regulatory agencies that are controlling and making sure that we're doing as we should. Sometimes they get out of hand. Sometimes they're not as well educated on the cutting edge of technology, which is a problem. We've experienced that in the past where, you know, you're coming up with a new assay for this this virus. No one's ever seen it before. You're coming up with technologies that no one's ever used before. You present that to the FDA. You say, okay, we've got this great program, this great assay. And they don't quite always understand how it works, why it does what it does, and then how to apply regulations that may have been in place for decades, right? So that's always an ongoing issue. Insurance, when you come into that for the companies that are thinking about, well, what do we pay for and what do we not pay for? Unfortunately, I think they don't also have enough information to gauge it appropriately and say, this really is going to help us. It's going to help us save money. It's going to help us improve our workforce. It's going to help us, you know, there's those business metrics that you want to be able to improve upon. And the insurance companies sometimes are not really as well educated either, right? So that trickles down to the company. The company says, well, insurance company must know better. Right. So medical directors at companies, I think, could really help to serve their employees if they were kind of better informed. And how you get that to them is always a question, right? It can't come from the insurance company. It has to come from some independent peer-reviewed method, right? So that they can say, well, we trust this. It's not one person. It's not me saying it's great. It's a group of well-informed people who are coming together to say, we've done the science, we've done the analysis, we think that this is going to be a good thing for you. And we see a lot of innovation in medicine. A lot of it doesn't ever get to market, doesn't ever get to the client or to the patient, because no one knows how to explain it. No one knows how to interpret it. And no one knows how to use it.
Do you think the good stuff will eventually get there?
I hope so.
Are we sitting on stuff that we all wish we had?
We sit on a lot.
Yeah.
We've got some universities here we've got very smart people at the universities here in town, right? We've got a number of them that have
medical. The Athens of the South.
And it's amazing how much technology is derived and built and conceptualized at these universities that never gets to market, never gets to the people who need it. And I've personally witnessed this, that, you know, sometimes a really great idea, a really great process is developed at the university and it doesn't ever make it to the business world, never makes it to a diagnostic lab, never makes it to the patient. So, you know, if you were able to use a precision approach, and I've done this for a number of years, trying to advocate for precision medicine, rather than say, you know, everybody can benefit by this drug. Well, some people will and some people won't. And there are things that are very well defined that tell us if you will or won't respond to a drug. Why don't we use those technologies? They've been around for a long time. We understand them well, but the medical community doesn't understand it well, right? Scientifically, we understand it well. We know the mechanism. I can give you a good example of that. Let's just say you needed to have a heart drug. Let's say you got a clotting issue. The drug companies have produced these drugs. They're on the market. They don't work for everybody. They work for some, but not for others. Well, wouldn't it be useful to you to know if it worked for you in particular, as opposed to just in general? Well, there's enzymes in your liver that we can detect, and we can determine whether or not you would or would not benefit from the drug. If you were the consumer, I would think you'd like, tell me if that works for me or not. I don't want to go through the trouble of trial and error and testing the drug to see if it works, just to find out that it doesn't.
Right.
Especially if it's a cardiovascular thing, right? If it doesn't work and you have a stroke or heart attack, there's no second opportunity. Well, there's no second opportunity, right?
Right.
If it was something else that, like, you know, for your hay fever or something, if it didn't work, you try another one. It's not a fatal event if it doesn't work. But if we have that ability to do that, how come we don't use it, right? And there are a lot of technologies like that. We know the science of it, but it never makes it
to the business world.
To the business world, never makes it to the consumer, never makes it to the hospital.
So we need more Mr. Wonderfuls and Mark Cubans to come in and do something.
We have a mutual friend, Dr. Brad Bale. I'll give him a shout out.
Hey.
You know, he was very instrumental in my recovery, you know, post COVID. And you know, all the genetic testing and all the blood tests and all those things that he wanted to run, insurance wouldn't cover any of that stuff. A lot of what we talked about was, how the standard of care can be kind of thrown out there by doctors. And it, you know, like, he was looking at my, my arteries, for plaque. And he was explaining that, you know, based on a standard of care, like if you've got blood flow, then yeah, they just say you're fine, but you may have plaque building up and you may be, you know, getting ready to have a major issue. But if you don't do this one test, you just won't know, but doctors won't order it because of the standard of care and insurance won't pay for it. And
right. Thank God we had him in our sphere.
Yeah.
Because if not, you know.
And he's one of those examples of physicians who have really gone to great depths to try to understand what's out there.
Right.
You know, his philosophy, I've known Brad for a long time. I mean, we're friends, we've published together, we've done a lot of work together. He'll go into the science. He'll dig into the science to find out, is there something here that's going to help him do a better job for his patients? And he does this constantly and he teaches on it. Right. And the unfortunate thing is there's not as much reach, you know, for what he's doing. And there are others in the space. I mean, functional medicine physicians think the same way. They think about, how do I get to the root? How do I understand what to do here? How do I treat the patient better? Because I want the patient to live a long life. And all of those tools that we have, you know, it shouldn't be determined by insurance whether they get deployed, right? Which is, you know, if you're, you know, minded in such a way, you're willing to pay out of pocket. I'm willing to pay out of pocket if somebody's got a better solution.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's right.
Because I figure if I'm going to pay, you know, $1,000 in insurance every month for their coverage, and they're going to reject most of the things that are going to help me to be better, to live longer, why wouldn't I spend that $1,000 directly with the provider, whoever that is, and say, okay, you treat me using the best science that you can, the best technology that you can, and I'm going to pay you what I would pay the insurance companies who don't want to cover this. I'm going to pay you to keep me healthy.
Right.
If people did that more and they were more hooked into their own wellness, right? That's, I think, one of the things we've had as maybe a potential deficit is we haven't given people in general the ability to advocate for themselves and say, I want to get better and these things are going to make me better. Mm-hmm. Right. And I want to use my money to do that. Insurance is one of those weird sort of things that if you go to an insurance company and you say, you have 1 million patients that have cardiovascular disease, I've got a tool that's going to help you save money. They don't want that because they're mandated to spend a certain amount of money.
Right.
And they want to pick and choose what they want to spend the money on. It's not always necessarily what's going to make their clients healthier, right? There's this whole weird financial, veil that you have to get past to understand why they do what they do, right? And now we're seeing more employers who are saying, we're going to take that into our own hands. We're going to hire a medical director who is going to look at our population and decide how we're going to spend our money. The insurance company is not going to decide. The company is going to decide, right? So I've worked with some of those groups also, and many of them, their biggest expenses are cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and behavioral medicine, right? So they lose people because they have a heart attack or they have diabetes or they have depression or anxiety and they miss work or, you know, they're not fully participating employees for whatever reason, right? And if you can offer them a tool that makes the employee happier, less anxious, more desirous of coming to work, you know, everything improves, right? So companies are saying, I'm just going to put that money I would have paid for the insurance company, I'm going to put it in my own fund over here, and we're going to spend it as we see fit.
Right.
And we're going to hire somebody who, like a Dr. Bale, who goes in the literature and says, this is what's best for our people, right? Whatever that is, manufacturing or, you know, whatever the business is,
right?
There's a certain set of things that I think for that population are going to be most beneficial, right? If you're in a mining company, you probably want to be checking people's lungs to make sure they're healthy, right? You want to do things. So as we start to see more of that coming and we start to foster that more, I think we'll get better in terms of giving people access to tools that they need, right? And not somebody in some corporation somewhere is deciding on an insurance level, Sure. This is good for you. Good for
people
you.
Are so suspicious though of insurance companies, of doctors, of pharmaceutical companies, you know, and that sort of suspicion is often based in ignorance. You're the one that is the expert at so much of this that's going on. Are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic where we're headed in the next 10, 20, 30 years? Medically?
Cautiously optimistic.
Okay.
I'd say that much.
Yeah.
And I think if we could get the word out, if more education was being absorbed, right? Mm-hmm. If insurance companies and groups were better educated about why you should choose this over this.
Right.
Drug companies, you know, they have as a target a bottom line for their stock price, right?
Sure. Sure.
I don't know, and this is just my personal opinion, you know.
Hopefully. That's what we're here to do.
Hopefully none of them come after me.
Right, but, right.
You know, is that they're not always looking for the things that are going to help the population that they're serving as well, right?
The insurance company.
Yeah. Well, the insurance company, I mean, has a certain vested interest, right? The drug company, if you look at what's on the, you know, you watch TV at all, and there's like 50 commercials for all kinds of different things.
I'm on the most popular one right now. I lost 100 pounds and my blood pressure is under control. So I'm loving pharma.
So, you know, for some of the things that they're providing commercials and developing drugs for, they're fairly small niche drugs.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Small niche. There's a small number of patients that have it, right? But because there's a small number of patients that have it, the price that you can charge is astronomical for some of these things, right? If you have a genetic disorder, and they're the only drug that you have on the market, you know, some of those drugs are $50,000, $100,000,
$200,000. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is that doesn't seem fair, right?
Sure.
The most vulnerable group right here needs help. And the help is priced out of range.
Mm.
And the insurance is not going to cover it because it's a rare event, pre-existing maybe if it's genetic. So the whole medical system just seems to be just a little off kilter.
Got it.
Providers themselves are trying to get information, but who do they get the information from? Do they get it from the drug company, from the rep who comes in and say, hey, you should be prescribing this? Or are they getting it from their own deep dive into the literature, right?
Right, right.
That's kind of the difference between somebody like a Dr. Bale who will go and scour the literature and find out, is this something I need to give my patients?
Right.
Yes or no? Does the evidence support that this is good, right? Does every doctor do that? Probably not.
Sure.
They don't have time,
right?
Which is, I think, another reason why a lot of where we're moving to is more of a concierge, right? Where the doctor has enough time.
Yes.
They only see 200 patients a year. I mean, my doctor probably only sees 300 patients a year. That means when I go see him, he gives me hours of time.
Right.
Right. And he's in the literature. And if I ask him about something, I say, hey, what do you think about these GLP-1s?
Yes.
He knows, right? If I go and talk to my family practice doctor, the only thing they know about him is what they were told by the rep.
That's right.
Right. Which may be sufficient for their purposes, but if you really wanted to understand the mechanism of why this works and whether it's good for your patient and whether it's going to do some harm to your patient, certain patients, you got to dig into it.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, when I went to my doctor 2 years ago, when I first heard about it through my wife, my doctor said, no, said we don't do that. And I got my wife on the phone who works for the company, and she pointed them to some of the literature. And about a week and a half later, my doctor called me back and said, this is showing some promise, and I've done the deep dive, and yeah, let's do it. And it worked.
But the majority probably don't.
Right.
The majority of them probably don't. They stick to a standard of care.
Right.
So if you're a patient with diabetes,
right.
You know, the American Diabetes Association has a list of of standards that they want you to live to, right?
Yeah, I was very thankful my doctor was willing to do the research. I thought it was interesting. I didn't like being told no at first, right?
Yeah.
And but I thought it put a lot more confidence in my mind for my doctor that she said no and then did the deep dive and then called me back and said, you know, I've really researched this and I think we should go for it. So,
but you had the best of both sides there.
That's right.
You had yourself as a personal advocate to say, that's I really want this. I mean,
because I'm married to a scientist. So,
And you had the doctor who was willing to go and say, all right,
that's
send me the literature. Let me see for myself if I'm convinced.
Right.
And if I'm not convinced, then the answer is still no, at least from them.
That's right.
Right. because I understand that they have a certain degree of liability, right? Sure. They're going to prescribe something to you off label. And if something goes bad, then,
right,
you know, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. Your family may, despite the fact that you asked for it,
right,
may not really be too happy with the doctor for having sure. done that, right? So I think there's a lot of hesitancy to do things that are cutting edge because of that mm-hmm. issue of what's going to happen if this goes wrong.
Yeah.
Right.
Cause the whole thing blew my mind.
And that's not just the healthcare. That's also our legal community has pushed us to a place where everyone's afraid of everything.
And there's commercials that if you feel bad or you, if you, something happened when you took this medicine, so.
Which is going to happen.
Right.
And it's going to, it will happen because not every single one of us is exactly the same.
Sure.
So that comes back to that precision approach to things, that if you look at a patient and you say, this drug works 6 out of 10 times, right? Works really well 6 out of 10 times. Are you the 6? Are you the 4?
Right.
And I think it's useful and valuable to find out which side are you on. If you're on the 4, we need to pick something different. Mm-hmm. If you're on the 6, let's go forward with this. It's going to work for you. We're confident.
And the genetics test is a one-time thing. It's one and done.
I mean, short of having a liver transplant,
right?
You know, your mm-hmm. enzymes are not going to change.
Gotcha.
So if you were afforded, if a consumer or a patient was afforded that option,
right?
And we say, clearly, this is going to be an out-of-pocket thing. But what it's going to do is it's going to help us understand as you grow older, it's going to help us understand what will and won't work for you. Because one of the good things about all of the effort that has to get done to get a regulatory approval for something is you have to very well define what that drug does, how it does it, right? So we know if you know, one of the big pharma companies comes up with a new drug, they have to define, does it get metabolized from the liver? Does it do this? Does it do this? Does it do this? That's all part of that regulatory mm-hmm. framework that we have. And if we know how it's metabolized, then I can test you. And I can know your metabolism pathway for that particular drug is effective or not. There are also occasions when that pathway is hyperspeed. So that means if I give you the drug, you're gonna burn through it much faster, and mm-hmm. it's not gonna have the therapeutic window that you want. So you're gonna have to have either more frequent dosing or a higher drug dosing, right? So some people get underdosed because it'll work for them, but it doesn't work for the duration right. that we expect it to.
Right.
So if you had that combination where you could afford somebody that option, it's a one-time, like you say, it's a one-time thing. And you carry that in your wallet from now forward. And every time somebody prescribes a drug to you, you can say, no, that's not going to work. And you be your own self-advocate.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Which is probably the future.
I hope it's the future, but I was in this space 10 years ago and we were trying to get this same technology 10 years ago and no one would adopt it.
Interesting. How do you get around if you tell me you tested me, okay, I've got these things in my future, or I have the potential for whatever. How do you get around the issue of the pre-existing whatever, or an insurance company saying, you have this knowledge now, we won't cover you.
That's a challenge.
Because I have to tell them, right? If I know something.
No.
I don't.
No, they didn't pay for the test. They don't have any right to your personal information as far as
I'm concerned. It's not on some database that I don't know about.
It's not on the, no, actually there are laws against that.
Oh, right?
There is a GINA law that's meant to protect you. So if you,
that's why I've never had my DNA tested. I figured somehow they all had it on a register somewhere.
That's the fear.
Yeah.
Is that my ignorance. At least there's access to it, but it's anonymized. Right. Gotcha. So some of the bigger companies that got into this genomic testing space years ago, part of what they did is they built these huge databases.
Right.
And there's a couple of very notable people in the space, right?
It scared me to death.
That have these huge databases, hundreds of thousands, millions of people, right? If they anonymize that now becomes a commodity that they can sell, mm-hmm. which they did, right? These two big companies sold the access to the database to Big Pharma so that Big Pharma could look for targets that they could develop a drug to. There's no personal information associated with that. It's been very heavily scrubbed before that goes off. So all they know is, out of this 100,000 people, there were 50 of them that have this rare genetic disorder.
So their names,
but they don't know who they are, right? if you go and you do this yourself and the insurance company pays for it, there is always that risk that they say, well, we paid for it, so we want access to that. It's in your permanent record, right?
Yeah, that permanent record ever since kindergarten.
Never seems to go away, does it? It's always following you. But if you did that independently,
right?
If you contracted with a company, it's in their database, yes, but they are restricted from sharing that with anybody. Mm. So that GINA law is intended to protect you from an insurance company or somebody else coming in and saying, well, you have this issue. We know, you know, you've got this genetic predisposition. And as a result, we're not going to cover you for breast cancer.
Right.
Let's say for
breast cancer. That's the fear.
You know, so people are worried, well, who knows that? Who has that information? And the company does. There's always the risk that somebody manages to break
a hacker.
Yeah, manages to break it and they can identify, you know, the people who have done the testing. But even more so, you can probably do things that are very well, they're not genetic, but still give you some understanding if, like if we're measuring protein, right? So if you have a genetic break, there's a protein associated with that. If we measure that protein, find out that protein's misshapen or not functional, then we give you some information that's not necessarily genetic. So maybe that's a way of, and that's part of where we're moving now with Spectrum is we're looking at solutions that will preserve proteins. And if we can preserve those proteins, and I've done some work in the past where we looked at 7,500 human proteins out of saliva and we can detect the majority of them, which means that we have the reach using saliva as a marker, as a sample type to look at these markers and find out how you're doing. So rather than bring you into the office to draw some blood, if I sent you the kit at home and you can monitor your hormones or you can monitor your diabetes or your cardiovascular disease, you can do it, you know, in a non-invasive fashion and keep up with your own wellness, right? The whole intent really is to try to get people activated and engaged with their own well-being.
Right.
You know, now that you've had experience with Brad, I'm sure you're really educated about what he does and why he does it and how he does it. And
well, my wife more so than me. But
I'm hopeful that we get the healthcare gets to a place where people are more engaged with themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Advocating for themselves, not saying, well, it's the doctor's responsibility to keep me healthy. Right.
Right.
Beyond I should eat well, I should
exercise, I don't go to the doctor.
I should do that.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, if you are engaged in your own healthcare, I think people will get more out of it. Right. And maybe that puts pressure on the other groups that are, you know, influencing whether you do or don't get access.
I think it's interesting because my kids ask me about DNA testing. I'm like, yeah, you could do that to me when I'm on my deathbed. I don't want anybody knowing. But hey, maybe.
For some things, I think it's very important to know.
Yeah.
You know, especially as we get older, we know we're going to have age-related issues, arthritis or heart disease or diabetes or whatever. Sure. You know, the next big thing that people I think should be looking out for is liver disease, fatty liver disease. Most of us don't know that we have it until you have a scan or you have a CT scan or something and they see echoes of fat in your liver. I mean, it's an incidental finding, but it's going to be something that eclipses diabetes. And look how much worry and concern and business there is in diabetes, right? Imagine if it was 10 times greater for something else. For liver disease, it's probably going to be significantly greater than diabetes.
And none of us, well, people like me, have ever heard of fatty liver disease, because I don't even know what that is. But I have heard my wife mention it lately. There's some new research. So,
And that's going to be the next, probably the next big issue for healthcare is how do you manage 10 times the number of people that have fatty liver disease than have diabetes.
Man, I love having smart people around me.
I know.
I love
it. We could sit here and talk all day.
This is incredible.
It's amazing, but we are running short on time here. So I do want to...
You're so rude.
I do want to bring it back local and just talk about Nashville. You know, in Nashville, everybody kind of says that we're this big healthcare hub, and we talked a little bit about this offline. You know, hospital care versus biotech. You know, Nashville's trying to be more of a tech market now. But
are we the healthcare capital of the world?
If you could wave your magic wand and, you know, change the healthcare industry in Nashville in some way to make a huge impact? Like, what would you like to see happen for healthcare in Nashville?
I'd like to see the healthcare people here in Nashville get outside of just the hospital.
Oh,
right. So we are the hospital, healthcare hospital hub of, okay, of the U.S. But if you look at biotechnology that relates to healthcare,
right,
not so much.
Mm.
We've got all these great minds at these universities here, but most of the technology that does come out of those places doesn't stay here. It goes to Boston. It goes to California. Maybe with some of these people that are coming in from California and other places, right? People are moving from other cities and other states. Some of those people will be minded.
And we love that they're coming here. You come from California, you come from wherever, we'll have you.
You know, we have, you know, the biggest healthcare systems, you know, HCA and all of the other ones here, mm-hmm, right? And they've done a fantastic job of building that healthcare base here. Mm. But what hasn't really developed out very well is the biotech that goes along with it, the drug discovery, the diagnostics, all these other things that feed into that healthcare system that you get at the hospital. Those are places far from us, right? Yeah. They're in California, they're in Boston, they're in Research Triangle in North Carolina. They're not here. I'd like to see some of that turned inwards and say, how do we further develop what we have here so that it doesn't go somewhere else?
Do you think it's possible in the next 5 or 10 years?
I think it is, but it kind of goes back to what we were talking before about just not having the education.
Right.
You know, I don't know if the people who are trying to develop a biotech company here are really going out and trying to educate the people who do have healthcare knowledge, but maybe not in this particular area,
right,
that have contacts, that have the ability to fund a new company. I mean, we've got a couple here. And Cumberland is downtown, not far away. They have a number of companies that have been trying to incubate biotechnology. Down in Cool Springs, we had a facility that tried to incubate technology, but it never really got enough steam behind it. And this company that we acquired earlier this year that was founded here at Vanderbilt left Nashville because there was no one here who really understood what they were trying to do, how it fit into the hospital, how it fit into diagnostics, how it fit into drug discovery. So they went elsewhere. And fortunately, they're just down the road. So we still have them in proximity. But I know of at least a half a dozen to a dozen companies that were here in Nashville. They were, you know, baby companies coming out of the universities that had to go somewhere else because they just couldn't get the people here to go, oh, I see how that fits into our existing healthcare knowledge base, right? Once that happens, you know, there's a lot of investment here that we could be another Research Triangle. We could be another Palo Alto. We could be another Cambridge, right? Because these people here at these universities are wicked smart. So why do we want it to go somewhere else? I want it to stay here in Tennessee. I want to try to build it here in Tennessee.
That's
right.
Good.
Absolutely.
And we've had some efforts and they're getting better, but it's just kind of a slow incremental improvement, right? I want to see a jump. I was hopeful that, you know, what we saw with COVID was really going to give people more insight in diagnostics and more insight in therapeutics. And maybe it's coming. I mean, we're still just trying to get away from that cloud, right? Overcome what we had for a couple of years. So I'm still, again,
cautiously optimistic. I like that
we get to a place where we can see the fruits of what's coming out of all of our universities here.
That's good. That's good.
Wow. Well, with that, Dr. Dave Vigorist, it was an absolute pleasure having you on the show today. For anybody that's interested in finding out more about you, what you've got going on, is there any place you want to send anybody?
I hope you can check out our Spectrum Solutions. You know, so it's spectrumsolution.com. That's our main business.
Okay.
It kind of gives a list of what we're trying to do, especially in this, you know, from early diagnostics to therapeutics. We want to be the one-stop source for as much of that as we can so that somebody can really get deep into how they can make themselves better.
I love it.
Awesome. Well, that's it for today. We'll catch you next time.
It's a good day.
Thank you very much for the invite. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, that's a wrap on today's episode of Behind the Curtain, Nashville's Movers, Shakers,
and Tastemakers.
We hope you've been inspired by the stories of passion, perseverance, and innovation right here in Nashville.
A big thank you to our guests for sharing their journeys and to you, our listeners, for joining us. And of course, our gratitude to Accord Real Estate for making this conversation possible.
Don't forget to follow or subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform.
Thank us.
Yes, you did.
Oh, I guess I did. Well, thank us. Okay.
Like I was saying.
Oh, yeah.
Don't forget to follow or subscribe on your favorite platform to catch every episode and hit that notification bell. We've got plenty more fascinating guests lined up, ready to share their insights and inspirations.
And we love hearing from you. So reach out to us with your thoughts, questions, or suggestions for who you'd like to hear from next.
Until next time, keep chasing your dreams and making your mark in Nashville.
Oh, my goodness. Remember, am I talking to Casey
it's
Kasem?
It's the people behind the scenes that make the city shine.
I love it. Take care. See you behind the curtain.